Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
I'm going to discuss today the effect on British politics of the French Revolution and the outbreak of the French Revolutionary Wars, which began in 1792 and saw Britain and Revolutionary France at war from the spring of 1793. And indeed, war lasted right the way through till 1802, and then resumed again in 1803 and lasted till 1814, and then resumed again in 1815. So there were people whose formative experiences in every sense were set by a period of war that was longer than the two world wars of the 20th century combined. And on top of that, although Britain didn't have to experience or fear aerial assault, invasions were a serious prospect, certainly till the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805, and invasion forces actually landed, a modest one in Pembrokeshire. Maybe that's a place you send a modest invasion force to, and a larger one to Ireland, both in the 1790s. So it's not really a case that, as it were, this was a conflict in which Britain was only indirectly involved, which has been our experience on the whole of recent years, or at least in as far as that the war has only involved professionals and been fought at a distance. It was the exact opposite. A significant portion of the male population was under arms, some of them not willingly so. I mean, one is thinking in particular of the role of the press gang in trying to produce sufficient numbers for the largest navy in the world. And then one has extensive forces of militia and volunteers who are supporting the regular army, which was also volunteer, in trying to defend Britain against invasion and, as it were, winning the hearts of heroines in Jane Austen novels, but more mundanely, fearing the prospect of the French, who by 1810 had successfully seized Vienna, Berlin, Amsterdam, Venice, Madrid, and had often very brutally suppressed resistance. So one can think of the famous Goya pictures of French soldiers gunning down civilians in Madrid, which indeed was a description of what they did. And it's understandable that people in London might not have been terribly enthusiastic about those people who were on the metaphorical left of that period, the radicals, who were favourable to the takeover of by French forces. And, you know, there are interesting parallels, of course, with the situation over the last 100 years, when we were in a position of some antagonism, hot war with the Soviet Union during the Russian Civil War, and then a protracted Cold War from the beginning of the 1920s. Until the fall of the Soviet Union in the beginning of the 1990s. And during that period, of course, one had a whole host of those who fairly enough were described as fellow travellers. And it needs to be borne in mind that those who in Britain were wary of them, suspicious of them, or hostile to them were absolutely correct. They would probably have been victims of some sort of vicious so-called people's justice had the left taken over. So you can understand why a British society in the 1790s, in which the virtues and failings of that society were bound up in the notions of hierarchy and freedom, of religion and tolerance, of a kind of equipoise that didn't always work for the benefit of all, but which was designed to work for the benefit of everyone, how those people did not feel, many of them, inclined to support a system which not only had executed a monarch, After all, the British had done that and had not only abolished Christianity, which the French revolutionaries did, putting in a laughable idea of the sort of supreme being, the kind of sort of, you know, the original woke, you might say, deity, but had also, of course, shown themselves to be, when things went wrong or there was opposition, singularly vicious. And one is thinking not so much of the revolution devouring its own, who, after all, could shed a tear for the execution of Robespierre, but one is thinking instead of the simple brutality meted out on those who were perceived as not being members of the right social order, or of the right, or those who were religious or whatever, whether they were murdered in the September massacres in Paris in 1792, or put into barges on the River Loire at Nantes, and the barges sunk and them all drowning. One can think that these tales of what was going on, accurate tales of what was going on, not so far away, one can understand why these caused at the very least alarm and despondency, and more generally a real degree of fear. And indeed, the notion, the idea that Boney was coming to get you was one that many children remained very anxious about into well into their adulthood in the 19th century. So what does one then do if one's looking at the fact that obviously some people were radicals? There were some sympathizers with the French Revolution, and the answer is yes, that was the case. There is no doubt about that. And of course, there is, on the other hand, debate, long-standing debate, as to how large this group was. It used to be argued by those who were of a radical disposition that the inherent nature of the British was radical, and that this was only held down by the brutality of a class system, or a sort of what was referred to when describing the administration of William Pitt the Younger in the 1790s as white terror, etc., etc. Well, I have to say, most of the people who made those remarks had absolutely no idea what constituted terror in an 18th century context. And in practical terms, the opposition was allowed to make comments about government and to be hostile to government during the French Revolutionary Wars and Napoleonic Wars in a fashion which would simply have not been acceptable at all, as well as being regarded as deeply disturbing, during the World War I and World War II. And one has to ask that why, as it were, one accepts the Defence of the Realm Act for World War I and World War II and regards in some way the attempt of a government to sort of lessen the chance of revolution during the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, why one regards that as in some way wrong. I think that's a pertinent point. Administration during the 1790s did take some steps to which were analogous to those of the 19-teens or 1940s, though by no means as extreme. So that opposition newspapers like the Morning Chronicle continued by any standards giving comfort to Britain's enemies in their criticisms of the administration. Parliamentarians continued very strong attacks. There were attempts to overthrow ministries. And there was a period, I think it's fair to say, in the 1800s, of really quite sustained ministerial instability. In the 1790s, war helped to cause, it wasn't the only factor causing, profound economic disruption. I mean, this also owed a lot to poor harvests, which were related primarily to climatic conditions. But war, with the sort of loss of export markets, and as the French advanced, Britain progressively lost its export markets and became isolated. This situation, as well as the government soaking up revenues by pushing up taxation to pay for war, which took liquidity and therefore demand out of society, all of these factors created profound problems. And I think it's fair to say that there was a significant margin of instability in the late 1790s, but one has no way of really gauging how far one should regard this as being possibly a, as it were, near to revolutionary situation. And in some ways, one could argue it wasn't in England, although it was in Ireland. In England in particular, the extent to which the majority of the armed forces were engaged against the French, and in which there was a singular lack of what we would call effective or any real policing, helped to ensure a situation in which, as it were, the self-control of communities was the most important factor. And if one is thinking about in those terms, what is striking is actually the relatively low rate of violence or disruption in England in the 1790s and 1800s and into the 18-teens. I mean, as you all know, and it comes from the period after the Napoleonic Wars, we refer to Peterloo, the very large public meeting in Manchester, or just outside Manchester, which is attacked by the yeomanry who they try to disperse the crowd, leading to deaths and leading to, quite rightly, an enormous fuss. What is reasonable to point out, and this is in no way extenuating the situation, is that this occurred after the Napoleonic Wars. And indeed, what is interesting is the extent to which there really aren't an enormous number of occasions like that during this period of warfare. I think one could argue that we need to decide how far this reflects a kind of attitude within the country. And there was certainly a belief that ideology played a role. William Eden, Lord Auckland, a former Member of Parliament who was British Envoy in The Hague, having been British Envoy in Paris earlier, in November 1792, urged, quote, every possible form of proclamations to the people, orders for fast days, speeches from the throne, discourses from the pulpit, discussions in Parliament, etc., in the belief that these were necessary in order to encourage people to draw on their natural loyalty at a time when the country, and indeed Europe as a whole, was threatened by anarchy. Well, there was a certain amount of that. But, you know, one has to be very cautious of assuming that this would have worked if it hadn't reflected widespread beliefs. Or one could take the attitude of George III, who in February 1793, when the French National Convention declared war on Britain, George found the news, quote, and he's writing here himself, highly agreeable, as the means adopted seems well calculated to arouse such a spirit in this country that I trust will curb the insolence of those despots and be a means of restoring some degree of order to that unprincipled country whose aim at present is to destroy the foundations of every civilized state. Well, he got it wrong on the latter fact, but he got it right on the former one. And, you know, George himself, in taking part and watching, reviewing his subjects deploy for force. So his holiday in Weymouth in 1794, I imagine one needs to take a break from a holiday in Weymouth, saw the Dorset Yeomanry exercise, and he reviewed in the same year the Buckinghamshire Militia. Once returned to Windsor, he inspected the Surrey Yeomanry at Epsom and the Prince of Wales's Regiment of Light Dragoons on Ashford Common, and etc., etc. He was seeing his people, and his people were mobilizing themselves in some considerable numbers against what they regarded as a dire prospect. George, you know, you can, if you like, associate him with a white terror. It actually is a bit of fanciful, as you know, the king who very much saw himself as needing to govern and rule within the laws in all and every respect. So what I would argue is that despite a hell of a lot of serious problems, and Britain did worse, in, you know, insofar as comparison is possible, it did worse in the French Revolutionary Wars than it was to do in World War I. And whilst in World War II, the British were driven from the continent of Europe in 1940, first from Norway and then from France and the Low Countries. And the same thing had occurred by the end of 1796. The situation in some respects was worse in 1796-97 because the British at that stage were threatened by invasion by three allied naval powers, France, Spain, and the Dutch, and without the British having the naval superiority that they enjoyed over the Germans in 1940. And a key element in 1940 is that although Vichy France ceased to support Britain, it didn't throw its navy behind Germany, whilst although Italy did throw its navy alongside Germany, and the Italian navy was considerably better than people sometimes in hindsight have argued. Nevertheless, there were some Italian submarines in the Atlantic, but the Italian navy was substantially a Mediterranean force, not one that was configured to join with the Germans in controlling British home waters, which was the attempt by the French Navy from the mid-1790s to the mid-1800s. So in many senses, what is striking is that there was a protracted crisis. And during this protracted crisis, the British, on the whole, held their nerve. And that was despite repeated bad news and against the background of a lot of political dissent, both within the ministry over policies, for example, strategy in the 1790s, Catholic emancipation at the end of the 90s, beginning of the 1800s, etc., etc., as well as dissension and difference between ministers and opposition. And one way of looking at this is that the British had the maturity or the folly, you could take your point of view, to allow and permit conventional politics to continue, including general elections, and there were no general elections during either of the world wars, whilst the measure of French liberty was gauged by the fact that the French electoral process under Napoleon had North Korean levels of probity probity, integrity, and democracy. Over to you, Graham. I'm sure you're going to defend North Korea in your usual rather whimsical fashion.
Well, it's very kind of you to suggest it. I wouldn't wish to blow my cover so obviously. But so much in that tremendous panorama to discuss. I want to, there are two aspects to opposition. One is the constitutional opposition within government and those who influence government over, you know, the right policy to hold the country together and to see off the threats from primarily France and its allies. And then there is the enemy beyond, which is to say radicals, revolutionaries who want to have a French tile revolution at home. I want to start by asking about the maybe 5 or 6 years between the Treaty of Paris that ended the American War of Independence, the American Revolution, and 1789 with the fall of the Bastille. There were movements for parliamentary political reform during this period. Indeed, many of those who subsequently became Pittites were on that reform side, including for some of the period, Edmund Burke, the who subsequently thought of as a great Tory philosopher. Where was the reform movement, as distinct from the revolution movement, the reform movement in Britain going in the years leading up to the fall of the Bastille? And I ask the question with really a sense of thinking, you know, to what extent then it was either halted or thrown off balance or went in a different guise once the news from France started to spread.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, as you know, there had been discussion in 1785 about parliamentary reform that had not succeeded. And I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that one of the people who, if you like, was a reformer was William Pitt the Younger, who indeed was in some respects on the if more effective, but like many conservatives, you know, sensible reformers tend to be conservatives. I wouldn't say myself that the reaction to the French Revolution ended the reform impulse. It might have delayed the abolition of the slave trade, more particularly because of the chaos in Haiti and the Saint-Dominique, and that chaos made people a little wary about the issue of suddenly what might happen if you change that situation. But no, I wouldn't say that that the Pittite government lost its capacity to consider change. In fact, I would turn that on its head, and I would say that war helped to encourage a movement towards a degree of change, and we may as well call it reform if we like, between 1795 and 1805. You have the introduction of income tax, you have the currency going off the gold standard, you have the Act of Union with Ireland, you have the first national census, you have the speeding up of the and really implementation of Ordnance Survey, you have the attempt to introduce effective measures against strikes, which, you know, to my mind is a sensible response to the chaos of that trade union combinations can cause. I mean, you know, you might have some of your listeners think this is an appalling innovation. Well, not so. And I think that in some respects, the war helped to lead to a degree of modernization of the British state, which subsequently in the post-war period, where the state by then, of course, was heavily indebted as a result of the war, was not seen to the same extent. So, no, I would stand it on its head. I mean, I know you're just expressing views, you're not expressing necessarily your own views, which of course is the difference. I have to offer integrity, Graham, whereas you can offer simple deceit in order to interpret the folly of others. But I have to say that a lot of the standard critique of that period does the brilliant act of looking at things in the mirror and, as it were, providing a reverse of what actually occurred. So the standard line that if only the British hadn't resisted the French revolutionaries, we would have been a sort of progressive nirvana, is, I think, instead of which we had a sort of a movement towards a right wing and a more imperialist state. I think it's total rubbish.
Well, I would agree, but I wonder if I can focus on the measures that were, you know, well, what its critics have, as you mentioned, described as, you know, white terror, that the measures that the British government did take to suppress revolutionary sentiments and radicalism. I'm always struck by the fact that if it was such white terror, how was a senior Whig politician like Charles James Fox, who was clearly very sympathetic to the French cause, you know, constantly at liberty to go around gambling and fornicating and making speeches in the House of Commons. You know, if he was at liberty, it strikes me it wasn't that much of a white terror. Am I being sort of glib and facile to make that point?
No, I don't think you're being glib and facile at all. And in fact, I mean, the king was pretty irritated by the way in which Charles James Fox was more or less able to do what he wanted, which was the, so for example, in 1798, what the king wanted Fox eased out of the Privy Council because of the, the toast he'd given at the at the Whig club, the sort of anti-royal toast. But I mean, it was very interesting. You know, I quoted in one of my books, if you look at George then corresponds with Pitt on the matter. And, you know, the king's very concerned that things should be done in a legal fashion. And I think there is a very major difference with what you associate with the French revolutionaries, or indeed the kind of, and there were British radicals of this type, still are, of course, the kind of end justifies the means approach. That was not George's view. George was very much somebody who was temperamentally inclined to legalism and who very passionately believed that James II had been thrown out in 1688-89 for breaking the law and that he mustn't govern like James II did. And so I think you've got somebody who, you know, is not a tyrant, and terms like white terror are farcical. I mean, you know as well as I do. We live, and it's not new, we live in a world in which people produce the most absurd comments. In my recent Contrarian, I commented on the way in which some football commentator called Lineker had described the Nazi rhetoric of the 1930s, which included such joys as the Reichstag fire, the establishment of Dachau, the Nuremberg laws, the atrocities of Kristallnacht, etc., etc. And he chose to say that Britain today was the same. Now, on one respect, you might say freedom of speech, people are entitled to say what they like, and I would agree with that. I'm not opposed to freedom of speech, but I would also argue that what you've got by such a thing is what I call Holocaust diminishment, not denial, he's not that evil, but diminishment. Because if you argue that today Britain is a society akin to that of Nazi Germany in its rhetoric, then what you are doing is ignoring the rhetoric that was offered at that period. And I would suggest that you're doing exactly the same if you suggest that Britain in the 1790s was a period of white terror, because the phrase you're using deliberately is terror. There was a reign of terror in France, and that was far more violent and far more controlling. The historian Hugh Gough, in his book on the French press in the 1790s, very good book, assessed that roughly a sixth of the journalists in the revolutionary period were killed as a result of the revolution. Now, you may have your own views about one or two of the newspapers that were closed down in Britain, but no journalist, to the best of my knowledge, was killed. The majority of the opposition press continued to attack the government. The only ones that were closed down were pretty clearly seditious libel by any stretch of the imagination. And again, to use the term terror on that is implying that there was not much difference between William Pitt the Younger and Robespierre. And if you believe that, I know you don't, but if you believe that, you're a fool. Now, you might be a professor of history, you're still a fool.
That'll tell them.
I'm afraid it won't. I'm afraid it won't, Graham. They'll go on making each other fellows of the British Academy. They'll go on, you know, giving research grants to each other. They'll go on criticising Tories. They'll go on pretending in the common rooms of Oxbridge that they live under some sort of right-wing tyranny. I'm afraid they won't tell them at all, because these people, I mean, the term the bubble is a rather farcical term. Actually, it's more like an ermine coated conceit.
How far do you think you at the time they did, and understandably so, it's not a criticism, but how far do you think the government's intelligence services were on to the more serious radicals, those who were a bit more than giving after dinner toasts and you know, having kind of fantasized versions of revolution, but were actually the sort of people who, had they had the opportunity, would have assassinated the prime minister or the king. As there were attempts on the king's life, you know, was there really any prospect of these outrages, had they taken place, really having any effect other than merely to kill people, only for other politicians or members of the royal family to take over?
Well, that's, again, a very good question. Yes, the British government did have fairly good intelligence methods, many of them long established. Postal interception and deciphering was one. And remember, they'd faced Jacobite subversion up to, I mean, the last major French-backed Jacobite conspiracy of 1759. There had then been British sympathisers with the American revolutionaries. But I think it's fair to say that counter-revolutionary intelligence was not at the forefront of the British state in the 1780s, and therefore rapidly it had to be put together. And there were officials who were responsible, and the I suppose you could say that we know about successes, we don't know very much about failures. There clearly were failures, in the sense that there were difficulties that were not adequately nipped in the bud. The final stages of the naval mutinies, I would have thought, in 97 are an example. But on the whole, the situation was eased for Britain by the extent to which the French revolutionaries helped to make their cause unsympathetic. I mean, there was an analogy here with the American revolutionaries. In 1775, a lot of people in Britain sympathised with the American revolutionaries and didn't really want to fight them. 1778, that changed pretty dramatically when the Americans allied with the French. You know, hey ho, these people are talking about liberty and look what they're doing. So I think it's fair to say that what might have appeared a relatively attractive form of French version of the Glorious Revolution in Britain, and, you know, joy to be alive and all the rest of it, and let's all go over to Paris and have the, you know, have the appeal of trying to overthrow a symbol of the past like the Bastille. That does change once you start getting large-scale killings in France, including people of all and every social rank. Of course, they murdered, executed women as well. I mean, and once you get that stage of affairs, it becomes harder, unless you're pretty ultra radical, to justify the French. Now, there are other things that you can do. You know, there's an argument, you've mentioned Fox. Fox argues that it'd be sensible to have a prudential peace with France, even if you don't agree with his political views. And what that does is open up a room for debate, but that debate already exists on what you might call, if you wish to call it, the right. In other words, William Pitt the Younger doesn't have the same ideological commitment against political change within France that Edmund Burke does. And indeed, that we should possibly discuss this in the future programme, because it's very interesting and actually it's relevant in a way to some of the issues when we discuss foreign policy today. But what I would say is that the French revolutionaries made it harder by far for by anybody that had an iota of integrity to be pro-French. And in that, they were rather similar to the Germans in the early 40s or the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Now, as we know, there were people during the Cold War who took the Soviet shilling. We know that there was Eastern Bloc money went into the miners' union strike against Margaret Thatcher. They don't somehow seem reasons to show that when they produce films sympathetic to the strikers. But the fact was that those people that knew what was going on, and even more, those people that had understood what the situation was like in Eastern Europe, including mainstream Labourites, found it very difficult to sympathise with the communists, and that was important. And you have an analogous situation, I would suggest, in the 1790s and 1800s.
And presumably once Napoleon is emperor, I mean, it's one thing to be a radical and think the ideas of French liberty, equality and fraternity are good, even if you find the bloodshed a bit hard to stomach. You're still committed to the ideals. With Napoleon, if you're a critique of court politics in Britain, it's hard to think that the French Empire is a more liberal equivalent.
Well, yes, I mean, very nice chap, Andrew Roberts, but his work on Napoleon is fundamentally deeply flawed. I mean, Napoleon, the best comparison with Napoleon, a man of destiny who liked strutting the stage. Well, Mussolini, of course. And the fact of the matter is that the man was inherently ridiculous, vainglorious, megalomaniac, and hadn't got the faintest interest in the ideals that he propagated. And of course, another similarity he had with Mussolini is that he devoted an enormous amount of his attention to casual sex. So I think it's fair to say that Napoleon's press in Britain was not a very good one.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should end shortly, but we can't do so without talking a little bit, you mentioned it, but talking a little bit more about Ireland, where the circumstances are different. Perhaps we could just end on what the consequences of not only the French Revolution, but French intervention in Ireland and the United Irishmen had for Ireland and for the United Kingdom as a consequence.
Well, there were no inevitable consequences, and although you get a mythos created, it is worth bearing in mind that most Irish don't rise in 1798, just as most Irish don't rise in 1916. There are two ways you can look at Ireland in the 19th century. You can look at it as a slow burn towards chaos and insurrection and eventual independence, or you can say, yes, there were difficulties in the relationship, and some of those difficulties were violent, and there were things that the British politics could have done better, not least earlier Catholic emancipation. But what was interesting is that, the practice of politics was in no way, and of religious disabilities was in no way as onerous as sometimes it's presented, and most of the Irish were able to get along with the situation. After all, bear in mind, if you want to think in terms of an egalitarian situation politically, that's also true for the majority of the people living in England, Wales and Scotland. It's not as though the vote was widely distributed there. So I think one's got to be careful. One knows what is going to happen at the beginning of the 1920s. It's a little hard to say that that was made inevitable by a course of action in the 1790s.
But do you think, danger of continuing that theme, but do you think that the unification of the Irish Parliament into Westminster should be seen really only through the context of the emergencies that war and revolution produced? or is that a process that, that might well have happened sooner or later anyway?
That's a good question. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that the Act of Union with Scotland occurred as a result of what the Americans call Queen Anne's War, and we call the War of the Spanish Succession. And that did not lead 130 years later to the, you know, chaos and carnage on the streets of Edinburgh as the Scots waged war for their independence. So I do not favour notions of inevitability.
Well, that's a good note on which to end. Professor Jeremy Black, for talking about the effects of the French Revolution and the wars with France had on British politics. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And those interested in my, as it were, method of argument, because you don't have to agree with me for a second, but there is, behind the jesting, I hope, a sort of emphasis on both context and conjuncture, might like to look at some of my books in which I try and look at the processes in which historical argument has advanced. But anyway, I hope you found that interesting.
Indeed, sir. Professor Black, thank you.
Thank you.